And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
Welcome to a special edition of the No Dunks podcast. I'm Lee Ellis. Today I'm joined by a legend from the Australian and international basketball world. He's a four-time Olympian, had two stints in the NBA, once playing for the Minnesota Timberwolves and later for the San Antonio Spurs. He spent most of his professional career playing in Australia's Premier League, the NBL, winning the championship with the Sydney Kings in 2003, and he joins me from his home in Sydney via Zoom. He is Shane the Hammer Hill. Shane, thanks for joining me.
What an introduction. Thanks. nice to be able to talk some hoops.
Yeah. Well, that's what we're here for, to talk about hoops. But first off, how's the situation there in Sydney? Are you allowed outside? Are you allowed to mingle? I know it's been a little bit up and down there in Australia, but what's the situation currently in Sydney?
Yeah, I mean, we've been very, very fortunate. We haven't had any cases for a handful of days now in New South Wales. So, you know, wearing masks and those sort of things and, you know, having to check in when you go and get a coffee or something to eat. So all of that tracing's big time here in Australia, but we're very fortunate compared to the rest of the world.
Especially where I am here in Atlanta. It's we're a long way away from that, but hopefully today is the start of something new. But anyway, we're here to talk basketball. So let's talk first of all about the NBA. And the biggest story, I think, still from this early season, the big trade. James Harden goes from the Houston Rockets and to the Brooklyn Nets. Now, before we talk about the trade, what were your thoughts on how James Harden sort of played his way out of Houston there? I mean, if he was your teammate and he kind of acted the way that he did, he kind of called out his teammates, he didn't really show up, how would you have handled that situation in the locker room?
Well, a couple of things. I've got to go on record to start with and say that I am not a James Harden fan. I can certainly respect his ability and his talent. What he can do is absolutely unbelievable, but wanting to be a teammate of his, no siree. And, you know, just his mindset. And unfortunately, that's the way the NBA's played. These guys are going to dictate where they're at. And if they don't get what they want, they're going to throw the toys out of the cot, suck their thumb in the corner, put on weight, carry on until they get traded. And ultimately, they'll get what they want. But, you know, I think Houston's going to be a lot better from it. They had to obviously demand as much as they possibly could to move a superstar on and try and rebuild again. And I think they've been able to, you know, get a pretty good reward considering the situation they're in.
So now that he goes to Brooklyn and he's there with Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving, can these three stars coexist? Because, you know, James Harden and Kevin Durant obviously played, you know, basically a decade ago in Oklahoma City, but they were younger players then. And now they're both MVPs. Kevin Durant's obviously won a couple of championships as well. Kyrie Irving hit the biggest shot in Cleveland Cavaliers history. You know, he's won a championship. He's a proven all-star, all-NBA caliber player in this league. But he likes the ball in his hands. Kevin Durant wants the ball in his hands. James Harden, of course, needs the ball in his hands. Can these three guys coexist on the court and can the Brooklyn Nets ultimately be successful with these three?
Well, it's the big question, isn't it? And, you know, I'm skeptical. With talent, no doubt, they can win a championship and probably should win a championship. But, you know, you've got to think about the people these guys surround themselves with. So Kyrie comes back and his boys are telling him, mate, you need to still go and get 25. You're the man. Those guys need to take a backseat to you. Do they know who you are? And then, you know, James Harden's going there and he's trying to do the right thing for a period of time because he's got to fit into other people's teams. So, you know, he does the right thing for a period of time. But ultimately, the ego comes out as well. And his people are telling him, mate, you've still got to be able to do what you're going to do. You're not averaging 18 points a game. So they know who you are. You need more usage. You need to show everybody that you can win a championship and still average 28 to 30 points a game. So ultimately, who's going to sacrifice, you know, when it gets to the final stages? And, you know, they'll get through a season. They'll have some big wins. They'll have some bad losses. We'll all talk about it. But they're going to be judged when they start playing against real teams. And the big thing for me is I call Harden Haren because I refuse to put a D in his name, because that's the question mark. Will he play any D whatsoever? And when it gets right down to the finals, who's he going to defend? And does he have enough pride to be able to stand up and give themselves a chance to win a series against a quality team?
I will say I was also sceptical of him, especially the condition he was in down there in Houston. It looked like he really wasn't in game shape. But the first two games, I thought he moved pretty well. I thought defensively he was active, at least there for Brooklyn. So he was on his best behavior. But it's one thing to do it for a couple of games. It's another thing to do it for the entire season. And then again, of course, in the playoffs when you're facing the same team. And teams look for weaknesses. They look for the sort of guy they can exploit on the defensive end. So that's definitely going to be an issue there, I think, as well for the Nets going forward. But they've got that offensive firepower where it's like, how do you defend those guys as well? I mean, who are you going to double off if Kevin Durant's there? I mean, are you going to leave James Harden open? Are you going to leave Kyrie Irving open? Jeff Green's shown that he can hit a three. Joe Harris is an incredible shooter of the ball. So they certainly bring a lot of threats out there on the offensive end. Defense is certainly a question. So this trade, when it happened, we heard that basically Ben Simmons was going to the Houston Rockets. That's what it seemed like. Apparently, according to reports, his agent was told Ben Simmons is being traded, and it fell through. If you're Ben Simmons, how do you now sort of just get over that and just go back to your team, knowing that you were virtually traded from your team? How do you deal with that emotionally? How do you deal with that, you know, mentally, that your team basically said, we're moving on from you, the trade falls through, now you have to go back and just pretend that nothing happened? Like, how difficult as an athlete is it to deal with that situation?
Yeah, I'll get to Ben Simmons. I just want to touch on one point you made about Haren. He's on parole right now. He's been judged on his best behavior. There's no doubt about that. So he knows everyone's looking at him. So he's a little bit more active. What happens when he gets to his normal tendencies and now you're playing, you know, your 12, 15 games a month, he gets back to not playing D. And the other question mark I've got for those guys is that the lack of movement. Those guys will want to play ISO basketball all the time. And you look at some of the greats and some of the teams that have been able to make it work with superstars and Steph Curry and Klay Thompson, obviously with KD, they move. There's ball movement, player movement, then they all get a piece of the action as well. That's the question mark for me about the Nets. But with Ben Simmons, I was hoping he was going to get traded. I think Ben Simmons needs a new start. I look at him now and it's almost like, you know, he's just conformed into this guy that's got so much talent, a good defender, but he's playing within himself. His usage is low. He's not aggressive. I'm not of the opinion that he needs to go out and start shooting threes. I don't think he has to. But I think he still has to be aggressive. You know, his numbers have declined because he's not even really taking it at people trying to score anymore. And I think the great players balance that up with being aggressive to put points on the board, but then drawing rotations and making it easier to be able to bring other people into the game. So I think he's a bit stale. I think deep down he probably would have been hurt with his ego if he got traded. But he'd sort of be sitting back now and going, geez, it probably would have been a fresh start as well. I would have been playing with different players that maybe complimented me a little bit more, and it would have been a new beginning.
When I look at Ben Simmons, you know, he's a point guard. He's 6'10". He's athletic. He's strong. He's fast. He's got all the physical tools you can ask for. And then I look at you. We're like 5'11". You know, not
so... Hey, you cut it out, mate. I was at least 6'10".
But the point I'm making is, you know, you were undersized for your position there, you know, and so if you went inside into the paint, you were going up against guys who were like 6'10", 6'11", you know, so you couldn't really go up and physically get those guys out of the way or out jump them like Ben Simmons can. So you had to develop a three-point game or a different way to score the ball. You know, if you were to coach Ben Simmons, you know, and again, he doesn't have to be Steph Curry from three-point range, but how would you work with him to say, listen, let's get a mid-range game going here. Let's just get some sort of reliable shot. Because, again, you know, you made it against all odds probably in the NBA, I think, you know, just because, again, like you were going up against other point guards who were probably 6'2 and 6'3". So you had to find a way to make it work. So how would you, you know, coach or encourage Ben to take advantage of those physical attributes that he has?
Yeah, well, I think it starts with, you know, as soon as the season finishes, it's about getting the technique right. You know, and I coach elite kids now, and it's about, you know, once you've got your technique right and then you're shooting with the right technique in close and then a little bit further out, and you're shooting hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of shots a day, and then you're developing it off the dribble, and then you're getting your step backs and everything else. For me, he's still flawed. The ball's coming out of the wrong part of his hand. His biomechanics of everything isn't lined up. So he doesn't have the confidence to be able to do it because it's just not natural for him to be able to see the ball go through the hoop of practice. And I'm not sure how much work he's done to make that a priority to say, I'm going to evolve my game. So the fact that he hasn't evolved his shot still shouldn't take away from the fact that he should believe that he's an all-star. And to be an all-star at 6'10", and you're right, when he goes into the key, he can go in and finish with either hand so well. His touch around the basket on his floaters and hooks and everything else is unbelievable, not to mention the fact that he's going to yam it on people as well. That he should be 20 points a game just by being able to do that and improve his three-point percentage as well. And I'm just not seeing his mindset, for whatever reason, really just be on that aggressive stage and feel like he's an all-star.
Yeah, well, again, I guess maybe that's a thing in Philadelphia. There's been a lot of speculation over the last couple of years. You know, is it Ben Simmons' team? Is it Joel Embiid's team? And they kind of do get in each other's way a little bit on the offensive end, because I don't think that Ben spreads the floor. And then you've got Joel Embiid, who likes to shoot threes, but he's not a great shooter of them either. So, you know, you don't really want your big man spending too much time on the perimeter. But you also, if your point guard's in the paint and he's Ben Simmons, you want him to be able to at least turn a lot of those opportunities into high percentage looks, which he's unable to do. Or he's shown so far he hasn't been able to really develop that consistent shot. But again, I think like any player, you know, they've always got something to work on, and you take all those other things that he does well. You know, his court vision, I think he's got a good basketball IQ. Defensively, I think he's incredible. I think he should be in line for, you know, all defensive teams. So he brings a lot to the table while he's still working on other parts of his game. But that brings me to, you know, the Australians we have in the NBA right now. And one in particular, I think Patty Mills is having his best season in San Antonio, coming off the bench there, averaging 14 a game. He was shooting over 50% from three. He's cooled off a little bit. But Patty, down there with Coach Popovich, who you obviously played for there as well, briefly there with the San Antonio Spurs, did you, you know, when Patty made it in, we knew he was very, very quick there in Portland in those first couple of seasons, but did you see him developing into the sort of consistent, reliable leader that he's become down there in San Antonio?
Well, he's always had this talent. I saw him as a teenager out of the Institute of Sport. He was there at the same time as Joe Ingles. And, you know, unbelievable talent, but he's continually been able to evolve. He's got a great work ethic, just that pure shot as well. And let's face it, Pop's been one of the best defenders over the last 10 years of Patty Mills' game. Patty came out at the start of this season and he said, I'm going with Olympic Patty now. I'm going with a mindset where I'm going to go make it happen. I reckon the last couple of years, Patty could have played a much bigger role in doing the sort of things that he's doing now. It's almost like the shackles have been released a little bit. Like you said, almost 15 points a game, 47% from the three-point line. And he's that sort of guy when he plays free. He's not a point guard. We know that. You know, he's a pesky defender, but he can shoot it from anywhere. He can shoot it quick. He makes his team better. And I think when you've got guys like DeRozan there that create so much attention, he's perfect as that next sort of guy that can put points on the board and do it quick as well. So about time Pop let him loose. Free Patty to be able to do what he does. And I think he can do it for a long time as well. Great teammate. And he's been great for Australian basketball.
I saw Patty in Atlanta last year after Australia beat the USA down there in Melbourne. And I said, well, you know, he must have been talking a bit of trash to Pop about that. You know, like that's their first loss since 2006. And he's like, yeah, a little bit of a joke, but I don't want to take it too long because, you know, Pop's still my coach now, so I might spend a bit more time on the bench if I give him too much lip. But it is great to see Patty just develop and evolve into that leader that he's come. And that game in Australia and Melbourne last year, or the, you know, those two games, he really stepped up and carried Australia, which was great. But talking about Greg Popovich, again, I know you spent some time there in San Antonio, and Andrew Gaze did as well. Aaron Baines has also played there. Pop knows a lot about the Australian players. Now, I know you were only there a short time, but did Pop give you any of that legendary sort of, you know, did he unload on you at any point? Did he scream and yell, or how was your relationship with him?
No, I mean, he was great. I mean, for me, it was so different, though, than my first stint in the NBA, because I'm already retired. I just won a championship with the Sydney Kings. I said, I'm going to hang up the boots now. I was 33. I said, I'll play part-time in Europe. I'd spent 4 years in Europe altogether, so I'll just go back you know, play after Christmas and play for 4 or 5 months of the year. And then all of a sudden I get a call up to say, can you come to camp? We're looking for someone who can shoot the ball and stretch the floor with Timmy Duncan. So I went there. I didn't have the proper preseason as I should have, and got there. And, you know, got cut a couple of times and stayed there for 3 months. And then the last time Pop said, we're about to make a few changes, hang around for the next 10 days and we think we're going to re-sign you. But I signed straight away in Greece and went on with it. But different stage of my life. And, you know, Pop's great. He keeps you honest, no doubt about that. He's a bit scary at different stages. Then he'll come joke and he's, you know, in and out of when he's serious versus joking. So I can understand what Paddy's saying. But, you know, just the culture in San Antonio is incredible. And the people they select and their superstars. And when you have someone like, you know, Tim Duncan, and the first video session I went to, I watched, he absolutely ripped Tim Duncan in the preseason. And what he did is he set the culture for every other player in the team to be able to accept being coached and criticism, because, you know, Tim put his hand up and said, yep, coach, my fault. And here's this superstar. I don't reckon any other star in the world would have been able to accept it and move on and lay that culture.
You know, Andrew Gaze, he was on our show once. I used to have a show on NBA TV and he came on and he actually said the exact same thing, that he said that Pop, you know, almost as an example, would call out Tim Duncan, because it's like, if coach is calling out Tim Duncan, then player 12, 13 on the bench, you know, there's no special treatment for anybody out here. You know, everyone gets the same treatment. But look, Pop's still coaching now. I don't know if you could believe that he'd still be coaching, what, 17 years after you played for him there in San Antonio. And again, the Spurs, not really championship contender material right now, but always consistent and always in the playoff hunt, which is half the battle, really. They don't have these huge peaks and troughs. They're just always consistent and, you know, continuing to perform. And again, it's that defense. You never, ever see the Spurs just play a bad defensive game, which is just an incredible credit to what the message that Pop's been able to send, especially now that he doesn't have Tim Duncan out there. He doesn't have Tony Parker and those legends who were, you know, with that team for such a long time.
Well, and I think the other thing too is that he set such a culture that anyone that goes to San Antonio knows that you're going to have to buy in. You know the expectations of the people that have come before you, the success that Pop's had. So there's a respect there straight away that if you want to make it and you can get through the Spurs program right there, you can play anywhere. So they don't have the peaks and troughs because of that and the selection of people and pride, but they'll grow again. They need another superstar and, you know, it goes in those waves.
They'll find one, yeah. Just quickly talking about another Australian who's made his beginnings down in Dallas, Josh Green. Hasn't had a real good opportunity yet to sort of get too many minutes. What do you know about him and what are the prospects? Because the Mavs got him in the first round of the draft here and I think he's in a good situation there playing along. You know, Rick Carlisle's not quite Pop, but he's in that similar sort of vein that he's been there forever. They've got a superstar in Doncic and Porzingis looks like he's going to be a pretty good talent as well. What do you expect to see from Josh Green over these next couple of seasons?
Well, I think he'll continue to grow. I think he's a really good pickup for Dallas because the way he plays, he doesn't want high usage. He's going to, you know, play out of the corners. He's a good three-point shooter and improved three-point shooter and probably will continue to improve even more. But he's a great defender, a good athlete. And I think when you've got someone with such high usage as Doncic and you've got the big fella inside as well that are going to get pieces of the ball, he becomes a nice little piece to them to be able to complement and give you consistency at the defensive end is what they've needed as well. So I think he just has to be patient in Dallas. They make you do your time there. He's getting bits and pieces. He started a couple of games, but not a whole lot of minutes at the moment. That over time, that will grow.
Do you ever hear from the younger Australian players who have, you know, made it into the NBA? Do you counsel them about life transition, you know, moving to America, different country, different city, big, lot of attention, you know, lots of games, lots of travel? I mean, are you involved in being a mentor with any of the younger men or women who come over here to play?
Yeah, more so when I was an assistant coach of the Australian team, because you're around those guys all the time. You're traveling. There's an opportunity to sit down and tell stories and all the rest of it. And, you know, my advice back to them was so different when I went to the NBA. It was 1996. Not many people outside of America were even playing it. And the Americans didn't think anyone could play basketball outside of America. So you had to do your time, and I certainly wasn't patient enough. I wanted to be able to get it done now, and you have some big games and you think, yep, I'm ready to go, and then you get let down and not being on and everything else. So these guys now, I think, you know, with Luke Longley involved in the national team and so many guys that are on the national team, there's so many more opportunities to speak to guys that are there doing it now. And when I was there, it was Luke Longley and myself that far, you know, gone.
I'm Trey Wingo.
And I'm Kevin Frazier. We're teaming up on a new weekly sports podcast from Wondery, Alternate Routes.
As former SportsCenter anchors and current sports obsessives, we're consumed by all the what-if questions that make being a sports fan so excruciatingly fun.
If you're like us, then you also live and die on the fallout from every drop pass, busted draft pick, and game-changing play.
Or play call.
Intercepted at the goal line by Malcolm Butler.
Sorry, Marshawn, still too soon. Each week on Alternate Routes, we'll take a flashpoint in sports, break down what actually happened, then explore every alternate scenario and the ripple effects it would have caused.
Follow and listen to Alternate Routes on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
I mean, the possibilities are limitless, Kevin.
What if Portland drafted Michael Jordan?
What if the NBA never vetoed the Chris Paul trade to the Lakers?
That's a butterfly effect for real.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
So, you know, you said there weren't too many international players in the NBA. Of course, you know, it's sort of throughout the 90s it tended to grow. And of course, you know, one of your most famous moments was a friendly game that wasn't so friendly against the USA before the Olympics in 96. I mean, that was an incredible game, an incredible moment. I remember watching it because Australians, you know, like when I think of the 92 Dream Team, the first Dream Team, you know, Jordan and Magic and Larry, that they were kind of like superheroes almost. You know, I remember the other teams were like trying to get photos with these guys and changing jerseys, and they wanted to be like, hey, look, I'm on the same court as this guy. And things changed a little bit by 94 and then 96. And then 96, I mean, that was a pre-Olympic game, Australia versus USA in Salt Lake City. But Australians were never the same in that, like, oh, wow, I'm on the court with Shaq or Grant Hill or Charles Barkley. And you didn't seem to have any nerves or any sort of tension out there. You just went out there and played as hard as you could. Now, you know, America won the game comfortably, but you caught fire to the point where Charles Barkley took a cheap shot at you. I mean, in that moment, what were you thinking? What were you feeling? And how close was that situation to sort of, you know, maybe erupting into a bit of a brawl out in the court?
Oh, no doubt. We saw all the other teams getting photos and getting autographs and these sort of things. And we said, it's just not the Australian way. We love these guys. Charles Barkley was my favourite player. I love the way he played, his attitude, everything else. But at the same time, I'd hit two or three threes. You know, he comes in late, takes my legs out. It was a cheap shot. Okay, got up, gave him a little chest bump and gave him a few choice words. And I remember him looking down, what did you say? And I didn't know whether he could understand the accent or whether he just couldn't believe what I'd just told him to do. Anyway, I repeated it and it obviously erupted. But our mindset was that, you know, we weren't being disrespectful or trying to grandstand. And, you know, I would have done exactly the same in the NBL or anywhere else. But I feel like what that game did is that we've always been a really tight unit as Australians. We play hard, we play together. At the end of the day, we'll have a beer with you if we don't win. But all good. And we got a lot of, I think we got a lot of confidence out of that game because we were ranked about 10th going into that tournament, ended up making the top four and having to play the Dream Team in Atlanta in front of 35,000 people in the big football stadium to try and go through to a gold medal. And obviously they knew who we were by that stage. So yeah, they'd scouted. Now I'd had 32 points. They weren't going to, you know, try, 28 points, I think, had eight threes. And they know what you do. Yeah. They want to get all. So that's a bigger challenge to be able to come back, you know, after a full tournament to play against them. But just great experience for us to be able to do it.
I was watching highlights of it the other day again, and Dick Stockton and Hubie Brown on the call. Hubie Brown, I mean, a legend of the game, and he was just in awe of you out there. You know, like after about the second one, he was saying, all right, get up on this guy because, you know, he's feeling it. And, you know, you hit a couple and you hit that corner one over John Stockton as well, and Hubie's just like, oh, my God, this is great. So if you can impress Hubie Brown, you know, you're certainly doing something right. I mean, you know, that's the highest sort of praise you can receive from a commentator, I think.
Well, I think because they obviously hadn't done, you know, too much preparation playing against Australia, they just go out and play. But, you know, I always had great range. I practiced from a long way out. That's what I did. That's how I made my living. And, you know, I look at today's game and I think, well, look at these guys are shooting. Look at the range. That's what I used to do 25 years ago. That's what I made, you know, a living from. And in that game, they'd go under a screen and, you know, I could be a meter or two out and I didn't have a problem being able to knock that down. So it was good fun, good experience, great crowd, all the rest of it. But like I said, it was more about us taking that into the tournament and finished top four, which, you know, we did a number of times, which is really... Yeah. For Australia to finish in the top four when you look at sort of the way we are.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you about. I mean, the women, Australia's women won the World Championships in 2006, and I think they've won three silver medals at the Olympics Games. So the Australian women have done fantastic. But for the men, we seem to be doing so well, but we just can't quite break through and medal. We've had some incredible tight games against Spain recently, which came down to some dodgy free throws, but I mean that's the way it goes sometimes. And then in 96 it was, yeah, we made fourth place there as well. Are we closer, do you think, to medaling? Are we further away? I mean, is the talent getting better? Is the camaraderie still there with the team, or you know, do you sort of see us maybe, you know, that was our best shot and we haven't been able to sort of take home a medal when we should have?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. And we've finished fourth four times. I was part of two of those. Lost to Lithuania twice in 96. It was only by a few points and we had our chances. And that was with Sabonis and Marshall and guys, and we didn't have Luke Longley. So that was probably our best chance. And like you said, these guys only a few years ago lost to Spain. We were playing against teams that had more talent and we were overachieving because most of us were based in Australia. We were a very tight-knit team. We understood our roles. Now we've got more NBA guys. These guys aren't scared. You know, they continue on. They've got more exposure about playing against NBA guys week in, week out. That gives us an advantage. But where the disadvantage comes, and my concern moving forward, is does playing for Australia mean the same to Ben Simmons, who's worth, whatever, a couple hundred million, as what it did for me, that I was just playing because that was my goal. I didn't aim to play in the NBA. I wanted to play for Australia. That was my pride. That was my dream. So some of these guys that are making so much money, do they want to give up time? Are they just picking and choosing? When they do come together, are they going to embrace what it means to be an Australian boomer and to be able to make a role to be able to win? That's the question that we've got. I hope that they embrace it and they're ready to sacrifice, because playing for Australia is so different when you play for a club team and you've got your role. It's about stats. It's about making all-star teams, you know, about winning as well. But these other things are really important for contracts, whereas with Australia, it is nothing about that.
Yeah, well, it's funny you say that, because I know when, you know, you watch Olympics or World Championships, you know, Andrew Bogut is incredible playing for Australia. Aaron Baines has been incredible. I remember, I've lost his name there, the guy who played, he played in the NBA briefly there. He played for... No, he's an older guy now. He was about 6'10". He played for the Rockets. He played for the Raptors briefly. Spent most of his career, I think, in Europe. His name has escaped me, but another guy, again, just representing Australia. When you put that green, David Anderson, that's the one, yeah. When you put that green and gold jersey on, players just play differently. Again, Paddy, Joe Ingles, all these guys, they just look much, much better out on the court because there's so much more passion behind it. And I just, like you're saying, that's why I asked you that. I mean, do you think Australia's, you know, men's basketball, certainly at least, Are we getting closer, or is that gap maybe widening a little bit? Because you see those other countries as well, like Serbia, for example, when they play together, they play great basketball. Spain and France, they're always tough. Croatia, they're another very tough team always. And, you know, I think it's very important that Australia maintains that level of competitiveness internationally. And I hope that's the case. So, you know, again, seeing guys like Josh Green get drafted in the first round, obviously Ben Simmons and Andrew Bogut was the number one pick back in the day as well. You know, Patty and Joe and Dele Vadova still playing. Dante Exum, you know, he's unfortunately dealing with another injury. I think the talent is there, but I just hope that we can still compete on the world stage, because I think there'd be nothing greater as an achievement for Australian basketball if we could just medal, even if it's a bronze. You know, I don't think there's any, it's not bad to win a bronze medal. Yeah, exactly. We would take it right now, because we've been so close without being able to get there. And some of those heartbreaking losses just they just seem like it's just not for us sometimes. But hopefully that will change. Talking about the WNBA, I wanted to talk about Lauren Jackson firstly, because she's been nominated for the Naismith Hall of Fame this year. She's already in the WNBA Hall of Fame and the Australian Institute, Australian Hall of Fame, Australian Sports Hall of Fame. Lauren Jackson, all the credentials, championships, MVPs, you know, all NBA representatives there for the WNBA, the Seattle Storm. I mean, what do you remember most about her incredible career, and where do you think she stands in the sort of Australian sporting hierarchy?
Well, I mean, she was incredible. I mean, she was really the first superstar that we've actually had, you know, in women's sport, probably with men's as well. Like, her accolades and what she's been able to achieve, there's no doubt that there's no men's basketballer that's done more than what she's done. You know, going into the WNBA when she was only 19 years of age, and then going on and achieving all of those things individually and collectively for a team, making a team better. But she's the first person we've really seen of that size that had the mobility to be able to step out. Normally, you know, when you're 6'7" or 6'8" or whatever she is, you stick them inside and, you play through them with a height advantage. But she had that mobility to be able to step out, just unbelievably skilled. She did it from a young age and did it all the way until she was a lot older as well. So, superstar, she deserves everything she gets.
Yeah, it's great. And, the reason I brought that up, first off, she's a legend, obviously, in the Australian sporting world and the basketball world. But you yourself have a daughter who's showing some pretty good form, Shyla. Now, where is she? I read that she may be drafted this year. Now, I don't know if that's true or not. Maybe you could confirm that. But I saw some highlights of her playing out there. And I have to say, I can see a junior hammer out there. She seemed to have that same sort of tenacity that she inherited, certainly that from her father. She's got a bit of a three-point game as well. So where are we right now? Is she potentially heading to the WNBA this season or sometime in the next couple of years?
Yeah, well, it's a bit different with the women than it is with the men. Once you go pro, and she's been a pro for a number of years now, she left high school to pursue playing basketball like I did. And so she's been playing professionally in the WNBA. This year, she helped her team go from last to playing a grand final against Liz Cambage and Leilani Mitchell. And she averaged 17 for the year. She's a good kid. She's unbelievably skilled. Her biggest skill is her passion. That's her biggest strength, because she just loves it. And we've done so much training and she's pushing me, and she's just so dedicated to be able to do what she does. Once you've become pro internationally, the year you turn 20, you're nominated regardless. You don't have to nominate in the draft. So she's in the draft next year. She just turned 19, but she'll be 20 at the end of next year. At the moment on the mock drafts, she's ranked anywhere between 8 and 11 on the main mock drafts. But she's up against the college kids that, you know, there's one of the Australian girls that's turning 26 next year that's been there forever, and there's, you know, other kids that are 22 to 24. But, you know, she's certainly shown she's a first-round pick. She was in the All-Star 5 at the World Cup a couple of years ago with three Americans and a big French girl. So great opportunity, and I'm looking forward to her sort of playing at that next level. She's ready.
Do you think you'll move back over to be with her, if she does make it over here and plays in the NBA? Do you think you'll move the family over to be with her?
No, it's we're very close as a family, and you know, she does all her preparation here with me, and then we let her go and give her own space, you know, so she can embark on her own journeys and have her own relationships, and you go through ups and downs, and we speak every day and everything else. But anytime she's playing in a season, I sort of leave her alone, like to sort of stay out of it a little bit more and just be on the other end of the phone. And then she comes back and we say, we get to the lab, we evolve her game more, and we just do the same things that I did of just training and training and training to be able to develop the skills. So now she's good, and you know, I can't wait to see her get over there.
A big moment in any father and child relationship is when the child becomes better than the parent. So, yeah. You know, I want to know, has she hit dad with a step back or a crossover and talked a little trash maybe?
Well, I stopped playing one-on-one with her a little time ago. So, you know, she's never beaten me and never will, because I've put up the white flag. I'm done. She's holding their record at the moment. We do a drill where you have to make 100 threes at the end of a tough session, and her record's 100 out of 106.
Wow.
So, three ball, it's unbelievable. But we were laughing today because all of the young kids at my camp, you know, they want a photo with her, got no idea who I am. They're like, oh, this old bloke, what do I want a photo with him for?
I think that was like when Luka Doncic was in Los Angeles last year, and Kobe Bryant's daughter was like, Dad, can you get me a photo with Luka Doncic? You know, like, and you see Kobe, you know, rest in peace, Kobe, but you see him that just as the dad there taking a photo of his daughter with Luka Doncic. So I guess that's pretty humbling for a dad when, you know, you've been in the NBA, you've played for Australia, and all of a sudden people are like, sorry, old man, your daughter's the superstar now.
Yeah, well, I think as a parent, I've got three daughters, and, you know, I'm equally as proud of all of them, even though the other two do other things. And you want the best for your kids. So when you see them, that they've found their love in life, their passion, and they're putting so much time in, you want to see them rewarded for all the hard work. And she is. She's got a great opportunity now. She's got a great head on her shoulders. She's got her mum's personality, and she's humble and everything else. So we'll keep that. But she's got a little bit of gets on the court and a bit of fire from me as well. So it's not a bad blend. And yeah, we're just proud of her and happy to see her doing well.
Do they ever ask you about that incident, you know, with Charles and say, Dad, you know, what the hell were you doing? That guy's like, you know, well, actually, Charles isn't that big, really, is he? I mean, he's undersized for a power forward, but there's that sort of, there's that camera angle where it looks like he's like, you know, about 6'10", and you're sort of, you know, the camera's coming from behind you like that, and you only look like you're about 5'4", but you're sort of like in his face there. I mean, did they ever say, Dad, like, how did you live to tell the tale?
Well, it's funny because most of the time, they're the only times they've seen me play is that, you know, the highlights come up, you know, all the time on social media. So the kids sort of see that and watch a bit of that, and that's about it. And it's amazing how many friends that say, mate, she plays just like you. You know, she's a lot of tapes. I'm like, nah, mate, it's just the drills that we do. I give her the same drills. So she's doing those same things, but hardly see me play. But it is funny because more people my age will come up. I'll get somebody either every day or every second day come up and say, oh, I remember when you took on that big guy, Hub, you took on that big Shaquille O'Neal guy. And I'm like, oh, yeah, it was Charles. But yeah, I remember too.
Okay, well, what we do now on our podcast is we play a little game. It's just it's called What You Got.
What you got?
What you got?
What you got?
I'm going to present two scenarios to you, and I just want you to pick one and tell me why you would pick one, and we'll have some fun. And some of them are basketball related, and some of them are not. Okay, now the first one. It's an interesting one because a couple of weeks ago, Bradley Beal scored 60 points, but the Wizards lost. And I know you scored 61, I believe, was your highest in the NBL. I don't know if that came in a win or a loss, but I know that was your career high there. So would you rather score 60 points in a loss, would you rather score, or would you rather score zero and get the win?
That is a great question, and I'll answer that honestly. We did win in my 61-point game. I reckon when you're younger, you want the 61. And if you take a loss along the way, you'll get it. But, you know, you're trying to do your best you can and pave your way. At the end of your career, it's more about the wins. It's more about playing the role. You're trying to win. You're trying to win a championship. And you'll appreciate that more later in your career. So I think it's probably split in two between me being young and me being old.
Yeah, well, we talked about it on the podcast we do, and I said, well, listen, I think I'd take 60 in a loss in January, but if it's game 7 of the finals, I'll take the 0 in a win. That's fine. I can handle not scoring in the championship game, but in the regular season, sure, 60 points, I mean, it's great.
Yeah, why not? Something to talk about.
Okay, now we've kind of briefly touched on this subject. The best teammate that you ever played with in the NBA, Kevin Garnett. I'm picking the two that I think would be down to. Kevin Garnett or Tim Duncan?
Oh, that's a great question. I'd say Tim Duncan, only because I reckon Kevin Garnett would have been a much better teammate later on in his career. I played with him when he's 19. Great guy, you know, really high and really low and everything else, but and good guy. But Tim Duncan, just unbelievably calm. For a superstar, he set the tone, he did all the work and everything else. He was a great teammate. The first time I remember speaking to Tim Duncan one-on-one, I was actually in the ice bath. I was the only one in the whole thing in San Antonio. It was the first day I got there, and he walked in, and I was like, oh, shit, this is Tim Duncan. And he walked over, and the first thing he said is, do you mind if I call you Hammer? I was like, you can call me whatever you want. You're Tim Duncan.
That must have been pretty cool, though. I mean, you know, like you're probably, you know, in a situation where I wonder if this guy even knows my name, but instead he knows my nickname. I mean, that must feel like, oh, okay, at least, you know, he doesn't have an ego about him anyway.
That was real cool.
Yeah.
That was
awesome. Okay, one more here from the basketball world. Best shooter, in your opinion, in basketball history, Ray Allen, Steph Curry, or Andrew Gaze?
Steph Curry, without doubt. I mean, what he can do with his range and how quick he is to be able to catch it and shoot it, how great he is to be able to get it off a dribble, off a step back, off of a rise, is absolutely incredible. So Steph Curry for me, first, Ray Allen second, and Andrew Gaze is just below me.
Just below you. Nice one. Yeah. The reason, I mean, like, I'm not sure, you know, maybe Klay Thompson could have been put in there. There's other guys as well. But I wondered, did you go against Ray Allen at some point in when you played there in Minnesota or San Antonio, of course?
Yeah. And again, you know, I was only there for a season and a half before I got injured. So I got to watch most of those guys more than anything else and didn't really go as head-to-head like, you know, I would have if I had to stay longer. But just seeing them firsthand, just next level with what they do, different size, quickness, yeah, and everything else.
Yeah, Ray Allen, I got to see him warm up a few times down at games. And the preparation he would put in, even when he was in, you know, the later stage of his career, was just incredible. You know, out there 3 hours before the game, warming up, practicing, not just three-pointers, every shot in close range, off the dribble, you know, around screens and things like that. So when you see him out on the court hit that shot, like against the San Antonio Spurs, that basically extended that series to give them the win, the championship, it's not like, oh, wow, that's incredible. It's like, well, he practices that, and he's been practicing it for his entire career. So, you know, that's and Steph Curry's the same. I mean, you know, his dad, Dell, obviously a great shooter, but Steph puts in the work and, you know, his range and the way that he's changed the game is incredible. So, I think Steph's the best shooter ever too. I think he's just remarkable. Okay, now you were born in Melbourne. I know that. So you did you grow up in Melbourne or did you grow up in Sydney?
No, I grew up in Melbourne until I went to the Institute of Sport when I was 16, had a year there, and then just went straight to the pros when I was 17. But I call Sydney home now. You can't choose where you were born. This is the best lifestyle in Australia.
Okay, well, this next question then, you'll be able to relate to it. Scoring 100 on the MCG on Boxing Day or bagging 6 goals in the grand final?
Oh, I'm going 6 goals, man. I'm like... 6 goals for sure for me. I'm a massive AFL fan. I grew up. I had to make a decision when I was 15, play for Carlton or am I going to the Institute of Sport? And love my AFL, 6 goals in a grand final in front of 100,000 every day of the week.
Did you wore number 23. Was Dermy the reason for 23?
Yeah. And it's funny because when you play basketball, people think you chose it, obviously, because of Michael. But Dermot Brereton was, you know, he dyed his hair, he had the Ferraris, all the rest of it. So as a junior, I wore 23. then when I started playing professionally, I said, oh, I'm going to carry that on. I want number 23. So that's why.
Nice, nice. Okay, well, staying in Melbourne because the big event's coming up there soon, I think, I hope, the Australian Open. Would you rather win the Australian Open in front of your hometown fans in Melbourne or the bigger event, which I think is Wimbledon? Which one would you choose there?
I think I'd pick the Australian Open. After playing in the 2000 Olympics and, you know, say Atlanta probably would have been much bigger on a world stage and dream teams and crowds. Playing in Sydney was in front of friends and family is just something that was so, so special. So I think being able to do that and enjoy it with friends and family would be very, very good.
What was it like when you captained Australia at the 2004 Olympics there in Athens? Because, you know, that must have been a real sign of respect that you got that honour to lead the team out there to victory in what turned out to be your last Olympic Games there for Australia.
I mean, it was a huge honour. You know, Andrew Gaze and Andrew Vlahov, Luke Longley, Mark Bradkey all retired in 2000. I came back to be able to play for Brian Gorgian and lead a really young team that included Andrew Bogut. So, huge honour. It wasn't one of the better teams that I'd played on, but we had a lot of fun and a lot of players were blooded, you know, from that experience and just something I'll never forget. To be chaired off at the end of my fourth Olympics, you know, in the green and gold, is something that I very much cherish.
I was actually in Athens for the Olympics and I was in the arena for Australia versus USA. We had a big lead early on too. And I thought, wow, maybe Australia's going to pull this one off. But because they had LeBron and they had Dwayne Wade, but they were obviously, I guess they were rookies or they just finished their rookie season in the NBA. And I thought that wasn't the strongest USA team by any means. And I thought, there's a chance here that Australia could do this, but in the end, they got us in the end. But that was a great atmosphere in the arena. Just again, you know, because you travel around the world, and when you get to, you know, join the Australian contingent and have the camaraderie there, cheering on the Aussies to get the victory, it's a lot of fun. Just fell a couple of points short, unfortunately. Okay, last question here, last one. Now I know you're a bit of a rocker too, so I'm going to sort of old school music. I think this is in your wheelhouse here. I'm going In Excess or Cold Chisel. If you could see one of those bands live, which one would you go to?
In Excess, yeah, I'm definitely old school. But well, I was in the car the other day with my daughters, and they had the music blaring, and they had WAP on, and I'm shaking my head going. I remember on a school bus, we used to listen to Dire Straits. I said, here you go, put the Dire Straits song on. And they listened to it, and I felt like I was 100 years old.
Well, look, this has been a lot of fun, Shane. I really appreciate you taking the time to join us here. It's been great going down memory lane and really, you know, all the best too for Shyla. Right? Like I say, I know that, you know, it looks like she will be heading to the WNBA at some point. That must make you very proud. I know you're proud of all your kids, of course, but seeing her follow in Dad's footsteps must be incredible. So it's been a lot of fun talking to you and thank you very much and I wish you all the best.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Thanks a lot, Shane. You could stay, ooh, every day, and I'd be happy every minute. It's been so long that you're the one I've waited for. It's happened already. It's gonna be groovy.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code The Athletic and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.